Hi, Alex.
Hey, Adam.
And hello, everyone. Welcome to Liver Talks.
Yes.
The Liver Fellow Network podcast.
That's right.
Alex, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's great to be back on the podcast. Also back in New York. My unpaid sabbatical has been excellent. I've enjoyed spending a lot of time with my son, as well as my wife, and being in a variety of different locations nationally.
Are you prepared for your first day of work as an attending?
I don't know. You tell me. You are my attending. I'm excited. I'm very excited. I start in a couple of weeks, or probably by the time this goes out, I will have started maybe by a day. I'm really looking forward to it. As mentioned, I'll be at Montefiore and really excited to join the team there and to be seeing patients again. I have missed medicine while gone, which is probably a good sign that I picked the right field.
Yeah, that is a good sign.
Are you going to give me some words of encouragement now or no?
No, I wasn't going to do that.
Okay.
No, of course not.
Got it. No. Got it.
I was just going to get into the podcast.
You're going to move forward.
But I can if you want.
No. I understand.
Yeah, I was going to move on.
Okay. That's fine.
You're going to do great. It's going to be awesome.
Thank you.
It starts out slow. You'll get your feet wet. Oh, I mean, I think it'll start out slow.
It's a promise you can't make, but I appreciate it nevertheless.
but I'm wishing it for you.
Thank you.
But then it'll, you know, your name will be stretched far and wide across the greater New York metropolitan area.
Okay. If you say so.
As I was saying, we're making a few changes to the podcast. One is, I guess the first one we could talk about, the one we'll talk about this time, is that we're adding a new segment to the end of the podcast, our third segment. We are welcoming a quickly recurring guest, Rob Wilchansky, who is the hepatology editorial fellow, to highlight articles from recent issues of hepatology that may be of interest. And so Rob will be found at the end of this episode talking about one of the MASH clinical trials that was recently featured in hepatology. And he did a great job breaking that down. So please stick around and check that out.
I will just say that as we've been talking about, neither of us are fellows now, which is why I got to call you Adam again. And we really want there to be a fellow voice. This is a podcast where we think a lot of our listeners are fellows and want to continue to have that there. And so one of the things is Rob, as a fellow, he'll be picking the articles he thinks are interesting and coming on to discuss them. And as you alluded to, I think we have some other things in the pipeline as well.
Yeah, we don't want to be like Wooderson from Dazed and Confused, you know? Like, we get older, they stay the same age. No Dazed and Confused? Okay, let's move on. All right, why don't you just talk about who we talked to today other than Rob?
So our interview was towards the beginning of our sabbatical, but being published now, was with Dr. Singhal, HCC extraordinaire, all about things HCC in honor of the new ASLD guidelines coming out. It's a great conversation. We all have patients that we see with HCC. And so it's really nice being able to talk to an expert to highlight some of the changes in the new guidelines and also have a bit of a focus on HCC across the spectrum of care moving forward.
Enjoy the interview with Dr. Singhal. Stick around to hear Rob talk about the featured article from Hepatology, and we will talk again soon.
So we are thrilled to have Dr. Amit Singhal on the podcast today. By way of introduction, he is a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine at UT Southwestern Medical Center. He is the medical director for the liver tumor program there. He is the Dedman Fellow Scholar in Clinical Care and holds the Willis C. Madry Distinguished Chair in Liver Disease. He is a world expert in HCC, which is what we are here to talk about today. Dr. Singhal, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks, Adam. Really excited to be here. Really kind introduction and excited to be here as well.
We were hoping you could just start by telling us a little bit about your current practice.
I graduated fellowship now about 13 years ago. Amazing how time flies. And graduated from Michigan, came down to Dallas at UT Southwestern at that time and have been here since. So I currently serve as chief of hepatology and the medical director of our liver cancer program. And my current effort is split between clinical work and research and administration. I do the liver cancer clinic about twice a week, so about one full day, ground on service, and then otherwise my time is dedicated to doing research and administration.
And not to speak for you, but it does sound like your passion has long been HCC. What was the original inspiration for your interest in HCC?
Yeah, I think Alex, that's right. Whenever I give a talk, my wife jokes, "Oh, what was your talk on?" I'm like, "Yeah, the liver cancer." Yeah, it really is a sort of passion of mine. as dorky as that may sound. But, you know, it's the type of thing where it started in fellowship. So, you know, I had the fortune of training with some great minds in the field. And, you know, my mentor at the University of Michigan was Jorge Marrero, who I think was one of the forefront leaders in this field and continues to be so. And I think working with him, I got to see how he had started the program at Michigan, how he had really started to lead the field in terms of research. And, you know, my early exposure to research during my fellowship, I think ignited my love for the field in the sense of having so many questions that needed to be answered and so many things that we needed to do better. And I think from a career perspective, I was somewhat fortunate because it was right on that cusp of this really taking off, increasing in incidence and mortality has kept me busy ever since.
You know, we wanted to spend the bulk of our time together talking about the new ASLD HCC guidance that you are the first author on. It's called the ASLD Practice Guidance on Prevention, Diagnosis, and Treatment of Hepatocellular Carcinoma, a pithy title. But before getting into the guidelines, we did this with Dr. Mary Ranello when we went over the NASH, or I guess MASH guidelines that were just published. We wanted to talk a little bit about the process of making the guidelines themselves. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that. And I guess a few things to ask you, I guess specifically how authors are selected when these guidelines are created.
You know, the first thing that I'd say, and you alluded to this, in terms of coming up with these guidances or guidelines and doing a good job, I think the first thing is getting the right people to work together. And I was very fortunate, even though I'm the first author, I think the guidance that we developed is really a remarkable effort that really speaks to everyone else on that group. And I was very fortunate to be one of the co-authors that worked with many smart people across multiple disciplines. How authors are chosen, that probably happens in a back room where, you know, very few people are allowed.
Smoke-filled.
Yeah, exactly.
Dimly lit.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, it's really determined by the Practice Guidelines Committee. And so, you know, there's the committee, the Practice Guidelines Committee goes around and they nominate people that are well known in their field. And, you know, this is, I think, important for many different fields, but specifically for HCC, it's not just the hepatologists that are involved in this area. They wanted to make sure that there is representation from different fields. Like anything, I think that we know that representation from having gender balance, racial ethnic balance is also very important. So you have different perspectives, you know, on these committees. And so you want to make sure that you have a representative group. But the Practice Guidelines Committee comes up with very smart people who they think could be co-authors. This is put in front of the actual ASLD governing board, who then vets those nominees and then selects the final group. I think the other thing that goes into this is that you also want to make sure that there is an equal representation of people who may have conflicts, but also have a large proportion of people who are not conflicted. Mm-hmm. So that way people can have trust in the recommendations and know that they're unbiased.
And I guess when selecting hepatologists as authors, does the committee or you know, if you know, select people who may have different expertise in different areas of HCC to sort of stitch the guidelines together? Or is it sort of a collective process for each section or each sort of component of the guideline is sort of agreed upon mutually?
At least from the HCC perspective, I don't know if they necessarily say that for the hepatologist per se, because they're also bringing in people who would be involved in, you know, the treatment side. They bring in radiologists who'd be involved in the diagnosis side. I think you almost get that from involving the other disciplines. And one can argue, you know, as hepatologists, we're almost like chameleons who can really talk to the entire broad spectrum of HCC management. But, you know, there may be some aspects of that where they know that some person is more involved in the screening side and someone else is more involved in the management side. Your point of having complementary areas of expertise is well taken. And I'm sure that, you know, somebody at some point in the process is taking that into account.
And how does the approval process for something like this work? And I guess from start to finish, how long did it take from when you had that first meeting to when the preprint hit the internet?
I'll talk about the approval process first. You know, the writing group obviously came together and they drafted what we regarded as a solid draft for the guidance statements. The guidance statements were then reviewed by the Practice Guidelines Committee. There was an iteration process in terms of saying that this one was fully approved, this one needed to be revised, et cetera. But one of the first things that we really finalized were those statements around which the document was based. It didn't mean that they couldn't be changed, but it gave a good base of which direction the document was going to go. We then completed the draft of the full document, once again, sat down with the Practice Guidelines Committee back and forth, and then we revised that as needed. And then once we had a full final draft that was sent to the ASLD governing board, they approved it, and then we went on. This process takes time. There's probably huge variation in terms of how long this can take. I've heard some guidance statements or guideline statements taking over a year, if not close to, you know, a year and a half. Mm-hmm. But I think the idea here is to get this done quickly because these fields are fast moving. And the last thing you want is to start a document, have something major drop, and then you're like, now we're just starting all over. Don't quote me on the exact length here. I think ours took somewhere around from very start to formation of the group to this being finally approved was around 9 months, if I'm not mistaken, which I think is pretty good.
Yeah.
That's less than I was expecting, because this is like, I feel like this guidelines is like a real tome. It's quite heavy. So to get all of that agreed upon in that amount of time is impressive.
Yeah, I probably didn't create any friends.
I was going to say, like, it must be frustrating to get halfway through writing and then some like groundbreaking thing drops and it's like, well, time to rewrite that section.
Yeah. You know, and that actually happened because the adjuvant therapy, believe it or not, we had the document on sort of the docket to go to hepatology and then IMbrave 050 dropped. And we're like, well, we shouldn't submit this knowing that it's going to be out of date within a week.
Right.
So we actually pulled the document back and then incorporated that at the very last minute. Good news, we're the first guidance document to incorporate adjuvant therapy into our recommendations. But frustrating part is that it took us a good sort of maybe a month to work out that last bit because of sort of the iterations and the dominoes that dropped because of that.
Perfect. So I guess the last question from a process perspective before we actually get into the guidelines. So there were 16 authors, as we've sort of alluded to, some from different fields as well. Were there any particularly hot areas of controversy that either made it into the document or didn't make it into the guidelines?
To your point, when you're coming up with a document that spans the entire spectrum of HEC management, if there weren't controversies, I don't think that we did a good job. Were there discussions? Yes. Were there heated discussions? Yes. Did anyone threaten to pull their authorship? No. You know what I mean? Like, it was the type of thing where, like, I think we did a good job of compromising and, you know, having intelligent discussions that we came to compromises on. You will see there is one recommendation, which is listed as 12 of the 15 agree. And really there, it's coffee consumption may be recommended for patients with chronic liver disease, as it has been associated with decreased risk of HEC development. Weak recommendation, 12 of 15 agree. And so here you can see that three authors disagreed with that guidance statement, which was the only one in which we could not eventually develop consensus. There's probably some other discussions which people eventually caved. I don't want to say necessarily on a record which ones those were, but maybe if anyone is truly interested, they can find me at ASLD. We can discuss that over a drink or something.
So we should transition to the actual guidelines at this point. As Adam had mentioned, the title gives away the goat. So it's divided into prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. And so we thought we'd go through all these categories. But before we get into those different areas, were there certain, because we're obviously not going to be able to cover the entire guidelines. That would probably be a multi-hour, if not day, conversation. But are there specific things within the guidelines that you wanted to particularly highlight or that you thought were sort of fresh and new that should be sort of pointed out up front?
Yeah, I think we tried, probably not perfect, in terms of the major changes we tried to represent in a table or figure. You're not forced to read all the text, although we would love it if you did. You know, but I think that we tried to really point people in terms of some of the key changes by the tables and figures. And so I would point out a few different things here and then happy to talk about any of the details. But from a prevention perspective, I think it's pretty standard, right? Antiviral treatment is sort of the best way to prevent HEC. But we pointed out some of the emerging prevention techniques from a primary prevention, and we outlined that once again in a figure. From a surveillance perspective, we really tried to give a different framing of how we should think through surveillance in terms of the overall value and weighing benefits and harms. And we talked about that this can differ on an individual patient perspective based off some patient characteristics. And so it's not just surveillance in all patients or no surveillance in all patients, but really trying to think of this from like an overall value perspective. Third, we talked about that we are no longer an ultrasound alone world or even an ultrasound with or without AFP. After discussion, we felt like the data were sufficiently strong to differ from EASL and to say that we believe in ultrasound with AFP on a semi-annual basis. From a recall perspective, we talked about not only findings, But we also talked about things like visualization. When you think through recall strategies in terms of repeat short interval ultrasound or going on to contrast enhanced imaging, including CT and MRI. And we talked about the fact if you have very poor visualization on your ultrasound, ultrasound typically doesn't work in those patients. And in those patients, contrast enhanced CT, multiphasic, or contrast enhanced MRI can be considered. Like the prior guidelines, we endorsed LIRADS as our diagnostic criteria, but we gave a little bit more guidance in these indeterminate liver lesions, LR3 and LR4, because we find that those are commonly encountered in clinical practice, but we wanted to give a little bit more guidance. From a treatment perspective, we stressed multidisciplinary care. I know it was referenced in the prior guidance, but we really stressed this as being standard of care and, you know, wanted to call it out as its own section. We tried to give more guidance on surgical resection versus liver transplantation, you know, really saying that those patients with Child Pugh A cirrhosis, no portal hypertension, surgical resection should be your primary modality, you know, so giving guidance there. As I said, the adjuvant therapy, you know, after high-risk candidates. And then I think beyond that, I really think that the advances in the systemic therapy landscape are immense. And that could be, you know, a podcast in itself. I imagine you guys are going to do that at some point. If you haven't, you know, in terms of IO combinations, atezobev, durvalumab being the preferred first line therapies and talking about subsequent sequential therapy in those patients as well. But really try to cover those bases.
And we'll get a little more granular into some of those things. But, you know, I did want to ask you about prevention. You mentioned some of the data not really being there, although there's certainly the low-hanging fruit things like antiviral therapy, treatment of liver inflammation and fibrosis, those things. But without, I guess, revealing whether you're one of the 12 or one of the four for coffee, is there anything, you know, preventative that you counsel your patients about or you think will be important, I guess, maybe by the time the next guidance comes around that maybe we don't have the supporting data to make it into this iteration?
You know, once again, I think that mostly we're seeing non-viral patients right now. So taking outside the antiviral therapy, we did all agree that we should be counseling our patients on a healthy lifestyle, right? So diet, exercise, try to lose weight if they're overweight, stopping alcohol, stopping tobacco. I think all of us agreed, even though the data for chemo prevention isn't perfect, I think all of us would consider those things from a general healthy mortality perspective and a liver health perspective. And we are going to see more data, I think, come out in terms of those that general healthy lifestyle being chemo preventive over the next few years. I am one of the 12. I don't know if that's good or not. recommended coffee. And sometimes I will speak to my patients about this. But I think that, you know, I will mention why there were some people who disagreed with this, because you can argue, like, why are people against coffee? It's so simple. You know, but I think that there was, sorry, what?
I'm just kidding. I'm teasing.
Yeah, no, they shorted Starbucks in there.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think the reason why people were, you know, opposed to this is that A, there may be some harmful effects of too much coffee, right? And I think that, you know, just like everything, some of these things can come out later. B, coffee, I mean, even though it's not perfect, can be associated with smoking. And so like that can also be associated with harmful things that go along with it. I forget if I'm using C's, if I forget if I'm using numbers or letters, but you know,
C.
At the end of the day, you only have so much time to talk to patients. And so some of this was a matter of competing concerns. And, you know, talking about coffee takes, let's say, 3 minutes of a clinic visit. And there was concerns that you'd be spending 3 minutes on coffee when you could equally be spending that time on something else that is much more important. And so instead of spending time on alcohol cessation and how to do so, weight loss and diet and how to do so, you try to squeeze in coffee and you're actually not advancing care, but it's subtraction by addition.
Personally, I find it to be sort of a builder of the provider-patient relationship because you get to give them something that is seen as a vice back. I find that to be effective.
Yeah, I think most patients, when they come in, they're like, what can I control?
Right.
And you know, when you talk about diet, we're like, well, we don't really know what the best diet is. And so like coffee is something you're like, you give them a little bit of locus of control. I think the question is, and you know, even though coffee has been associated with decreased HEC, we have to be cognizant that most of those effects are being driven by fibrosis, not a direct chemo prevention. Once you have cirrhosis, or once you have an LR3 lesion, is the cat out of the bag from a coffee perspective? And I think that's really some of the discussions we had. So the discussions we had were very deep in the weeds, and it wasn't so much saying you shouldn't do it, but is the evidence strong enough that this deserves a spot in the guidance? I think that's where the discussions came in.
From a surveillance perspective, are there any risk stratification tools that excite you in terms of trying to allow us to better target those who should get HCC screening, because, you know, universal screening rates aren't ideal. And it's very, you know, sometimes difficult in our practice to get everyone screened. But just curious if there's anything that kind of you get excited about from this standpoint.
I think that all of us agree that risk stratification is necessary for multiple reasons. Risk stratification is necessary. And, you know, to your point, there's been multiple clinical risk models that have been proposed, all of them performing reasonably well in internal validation, some of them being externally valid. But typically when you get to the C statistics on those models, they're somewhere in the 0.7, 0.75 range, good enough to get into like reasonable journals, but like none of us feel that great about using them in clinical practice. So like, I think this is great for building research careers, but hasn't quite changed clinical practice. I'm going to declare my conflict here. This comes from one of my colleagues at UT Southwestern, but like one of the ones that excites me is actually a biomarker that's been developed in terms of a blood-based biomarker that has now been validated in large cohorts and showing pretty good performance. And the reason why I'm excited about this is because it's different. It's not another clinical risk score. It's a biomarker that you can use. And theoretically, by combining things, by combining that biomarker with clinical risk features, we actually may be able to get our accuracy into the 0.8, 0.9 range and really come up with something that is practice changing. At this point, I think it's something that we need, nothing that I use in my clinical practice today, nor do I expect it later this year.
So also looking to the future, so once we decide who should be screened, it sounds like obviously right now ultrasound with AFP is the recommendation, unless ultrasound is not getting good enough images. But the guidance does mention a little bit about what the future may hold, one of which is GALAD, which is sort of AFP plus, if you will. And then the other being, I feel like this is the catchphrase for all cancers, but liquid biopsies. And I was curious what your thoughts are on either of those and when you think those may be ready for the mainstream or prime time.
So I'm going to declare my intellectual bias, you know, is that I'm a big believer in biomarkers, right? So like, I think this is where we have to go. You know, Adam, you already referenced the fact that like, we're not doing surveillance in a large portion of patients, right? So studies suggest 25% of patients overall. And when you take a look, even at hepatology, you get up to like 60, 70%. So we have a long ways to improve. I think we all agree the best test is the one that gets done. And you know, we know that biomarkers are easier to implement than radiologic surveillance. And so I'm a big believer in this. Now, GALAD, you know, when we think of phases of biomarker validation, GALAD has passed retrospective cohort studies. And I'm actually one of the PIs on a trial that is launching later this year, doing a randomized study of GALAD versus ultrasound and AFP. And so if that trial is positive, then you will see the next iteration of the guidance actually endorse GALAD or, you know, other biomarkers to be the preferred strategy. I think liquid biopsy, methylated DNA panels, fragmentomics, all these other liquid biopsy techniques are exciting. They don't have that same level of validation. Mm-hmm. They've been evaluated in case control studies with promising data, but not quite there. I think those studies are also ongoing, I think promising, but not used in my clinical practice today. And then the other thing that I would mention, just to put it out there in terms of other modalities moving forward, is abbreviated MRI. So abbreviated MRI is also going into trials moving forward. A large VA trial here, as well as a trial in Europe, that is actually prospectively looking at abbreviated MRI. And likewise, if those things are positive, you may see that be endorsed. Although I have a hard time getting an ultrasound done, let alone MRI my patients every 6 months. So I think that's a niche study that can be done in academic centers and select patients. But I don't think that's the answer for all when we think of our big cirrhosis population.
And then before we talk about treatment and some of the things that the guidance reflects with respect to treating HCC, I was curious, I guess this is more of your opinion, but are there any disparities that you think are particularly important to address in a liver cancer diagnosis and treatment or treatment?
The short answer is yes.
We'll move on.
You know, I think that, you know, HCC is one where disparities exist across the board.
Yeah.
So we know that from a burden perspective, both incidence and mortality, higher incidence and mortality among racial ethnic minorities, non-Hispanic blacks, Hispanic whites, American Indian, Alaskan natives. We also see higher incidence and mortality in those populations as well. We know that this is related to failures across the board. So we see differential surveillance rates. We see differential treatment rates, including lower curative treatments. And so we really need to do better in terms of increasing screening and treatment amongst those populations. And likewise, you can say there are socioeconomic disparities with low SES populations receiving appropriate care, having higher mortality. You see this in terms of gender and sex disparities, and then, you know, geographic disparities. So it's really across the board. So in a way, that's why I said yes, because this is like also a very long answer.
So we have some work to do. Transitioning to treatment, and obviously this could be a whole topic, as you mentioned as well. We thought we'd focus mainly on where a lot of the changes and new innovations have come, which is in systemic therapy, not to shortchange surgery and local regional therapies or transplant, which obviously we all love. You'd mentioned that sort of the newest kid on the block is adjuvant systemic therapy. And so we were curious, for patients that are undergoing surgery or local regional therapy, who are the people that you're sort of thinking about adjuvant therapy for?
This has been currently evaluated in the IMbrave050 trial, which took a look at patients who had complete response to surgical resection or local ablation. Those patients who were regarded as high risk of recurrence, and that's based off a few different factors, which I'll describe in a second, were then randomized to receive atezolbev for 1 year versus placebo. And those patients who received the combination of atezolizumab and bevacizumab for 1 year had significantly improved recurrence-free survival. And thereby, that was the level one data that we used to incorporate this into the guidance document. The patients who were regarded as being high risk were based off of multiple features, but were based off of size, multifocality, the presence of vascular invasion, and that could be micro or macro, or tumor differentiation. Those are the patients who were included. And I think that's very important when we think about applying this into clinical practice. Because even though that combination was safe, there were some patients who had immune-related adverse events. There were some patients who had bleeding, et cetera, from this different therapy. And so those patients who are low risk of recurrence, that risk-benefit ratio probably is not as favorable. And so we should really be restricting this to the high-risk patients as according to the clinical trial.
Using this as sort of like a launching pad for more broad use of systemic therapy, what are you most excited about in the future as it relates to systemic therapy?
I think the fact that we're seeing this diffuse into earlier lines of therapy really show the excitement, right? I think when we used to think of systemic therapies, it was almost like the last stop on like that train ride, right? You sort of went through everything else. And then when you got to systemic therapy, you're like, okay, let's try it and see what happens. But didn't expect anyone to be downstaged or didn't expect anyone else to, any other therapies to come into play. But now we see this proven of benefit in the adjuvant therapy space. Now you're seeing trials being designed in a neoadjuvant fashion, and you're seeing therapies that are evaluating this in combination with local regional therapy. So combinations with TACE or combination with TARE. So I think it really is a lot of different excitement in terms of how this could be applied in the future. And then going back to sort of Alex, our love for liver transplant, I think the exciting thing is that you're even seeing trials that are looking at this in terms of bridging to transplant, and you're seeing patients that are being downstaged from being advanced stage vascular invasion response to systemic therapy, and we're now thinking of transplanting those patients. So it's really transforming our approach across the board and allowing patients to receive curative therapy who would not have received curative therapies in the past.
What about a role for sort of post-transplant?
That's the simple answer there. So like, I think that like, I would say, and I say this with the current data we have, right? So we've seen data come out from Mount Sinai and a couple other sites showing the safety of immune checkpoint inhibitors leading into transplant and, you know, having acceptable rates of rejection using it prior. I think many transplant centers have now come up with their own protocols saying you can receive this. Some have built in a washout period. And the ASLD guidance specifically says this should not be a contraindication to transplant. Conversely, post-transplant, we know there's a high rate of graft loss and a high risk of death. And so I think in general, there should be, and I think there is reluctance to use this post-transplant. And many centers have said that this is contraindicated post-transplant. And I think that's true post-liver transplant. I think you could argue the math may change if you have, for example, melanoma post-kidney transplant, you know, where you're like, well, very high risk of response and you have a rejection, you just go on dialysis. It's not true across the board. Mm-hmm. But I think in patients with liver transplant, I think right now it would be few and far between that one would treat with immunotherapy post-transplant.
And then one last question before we head to the lightning round. A lot of our listeners are trainees. And a lot of trainees are still trying to figure out what research area they may be interested in. The last part of being a trainee is you obviously don't have the craziest long timeline. You don't necessarily get to do grant-funded research. You don't get to do trials and things like that. A lot of it ends up being somewhat retrospective, at least. The two questions I had was, one, are there particular areas within HCC that you think are fruitful for trainees to be looking at? And then are there certain, either at the bigger meetings like ASLD, et cetera, or are there sort of smaller meetings or groups that trainees that are interested in HCC would benefit from experiencing?
So Alex, Adam, I think that, you know, we've made a lot of progress over the last 10 to 15 years, but, you know, I think there's still a lot of room for research that needs to be done. And the nice thing is that these don't need to be done by large 5-year or 10-year clinical trials. I think a lot of this can be done by retrospective studies, survey studies, things that are very feasible for trainees to do. You know, the way that I think about this, and this is the way that I started my career, is to take small steps. Your first paper does not need to be a gas drill paper or like a JAMA paper.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. My first paper was rejected, I think, 8 times. So like it was like, you know, a little bit traumatic. But I think it's the type of thing where take small steps, build a building block, get your excitement up, and then you can continue to build off of that. But I think retrospective studies and, you know, those kinds of things, I think are strong building block to build off of. I think from a hepatology perspective, looking at things like prevention, screening, diagnosis, I mean, all of those are very nice areas. And I'm going to put a plug in for the fact that we do have a multi-site sort of consortium that we have developed in terms of trying to do research in HCC across North America, the North American Liver Cancer Consortium. And this involves just depositing retrospective data into this consortium, and then it allows us to work together to do multi-site research. And so answer big questions, good way to get named out there in terms of doing research, and you know, you form collaborations with others. So like, I think that would be one thing. If you're interested, feel free to reach out to me or, you know, any of the other investigators from the North American Liver Cancer Consortium to get involved in that, if that's some desire. Your second part was conferences. And so like, of course, great stuff always being presented at the liver meeting, EASL, et cetera, in terms of conferences. But I will also put in another plug for a small HCC conference, which I think is, and once again, biased because I'm one of the course co-directors. It's arguably the premier HCC meeting here in North America, has nearly most experts in the field who are actively involved in this, HCC Live. It used to be HCC Tag. It's changing its, not its format, but its scope to be even broader. But HCC Live, it happens in February. And once again, I would say anyone who's interested in HCC or liver cancer in general, this is the meeting which you should come to. Experts from all disciplines involved, and great opportunities for junior investigators to get to meet people, because there's a lot of networking that happens during that meeting.
It's time.
Lightning round.
Let's jump right in. As you'll see from the first question, this is in no way necessarily fast answers. And you had mentioned a little bit about this in terms of the changing treatment landscape as you bridged from trainee to attending. Was there a time where luck played a role in your career and sort of led you on the path to where you are now?
Luck's involved across anyone's career, right? Anyone who has had any sort of level of success, I think luck is a big part of this. Meeting my mentor at Michigan was lucky, right? I mean, like, I think meeting the right people in general is fortunate. I think my first paper that I had done was a meta-analysis on ultrasound with or without AFP. And I think, you know, it's like one of these projects which Jorge had on his desk, and he's like, oh yeah, you could probably do that. And it was just the type of thing where like, it was fortunate because it was the type of thing where that project actually became one of the more controversial areas in the field. And so like, it was a simple project, but one that opened my entire sort of career. Funny enough, I would say that probably one of the main defining moments, at least looking back in my career, was one where Jorge was supposed to give a talk at the International Liver Cancer Association, like this international meeting. For personal reasons, he couldn't attend. So he called me up like 2 days before. He's like, I can't make it. Can you give this talk? But it was a debate with Morris Sherman, who was the author of the guidelines at the time. And I was like a second year faculty. Like, there's no way that they would have asked me to do this. But, you know, he's like, can you do this debate? And my first answer was like, I can physically do it, but I'm pretty good. I would do a terrible job with it, but yeah, sure. You know, so it was the type of thing where the next 48 hours of my life were very different than what I had imagined. I thought I was going to go around Germany, like just seeing sights. And instead I was doing this debate in my head over and over again. And honestly,
I have anxiety just hearing this story.
Yes. This was a luck question, right?
it's opportune sort of situations, but I think I had like a fugue state because I actually didn't remember a moment of that actual debate. But I think it's like those kind of things where like, you know, a door opened and I took it. It's a little bit tangential to the question maybe, but I would argue as a trainee, you know, even if it's scary, because I think that all of us in our rightful mind would be like scared, you know, with that situation. But if you see a door, even if it's a big stage, step up to the bat and take that opportunity, because if you do well, people will remember.
And if you don't, they'll remember too.
But you know, Adam, I think that if I didn't do well, people will be like, he's a second year faculty. He was, right. You know, he was debating more. And like, you have nothing really to lose.
Yeah.
But, you know, as long as I didn't pass out, which I was at a fugue state, I don't think I passed out.
No,
no, I think that's great advice. I totally agree. So there, in this guideline, there are 335 references. How many of those have you personally read?
334. No, I'm joking. Yeah. You know, I have read parts of most of them. I don't think that I've read all of them. I can't say that for sure. But
yeah,
I try to do a good job of keeping up with the field. And I think that is one of the key things. I've tried to do reasonably well. It's good advice. I think it's really easy to get caught up in other things and to say, oh, I'll just let that pile of things I need to read stack up. Whether you're a clinical educator or clinical researcher, the only way you can take care of your patients well, or the only way you can ask good, clinically important questions, is to be aware of the field. It's very important when you're doing this. Now, you've given me homework, Adam, because now I'm going to look nothing here to listen.
Not our intention.
Please don't. Please don't.
All right. So the next question, since you agreed to be on, I've been excited to ask this. There are a few cities that are incredibly important to the field of HCC. We were curious, have you ever been to Milan?
Yes.
Oh.
Well. So the nice thing about the International Liver Cancer Association is it's international. Yes. And they essentially go around to important cities in HCC. So I've been to Milan, I've been to Barcelona.
Okay. So you must really be an expert.
Yeah.
So now I thought you were going to say, is Dallas on that list? But I thought that was going to be how to go with it.
I guess it can be if you want it to be.
Yeah, I think it should be.
Yeah,
absolutely. To wrap us up, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We ask this of almost everyone who comes on this podcast, even though maybe it's worn out its welcome a little bit. What is your favorite liver cell?
I mean, it has to be the hepatocyte, right?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
A hepatocyte with mild dysplasia.
Okay.
Here's a new one.
Extra flavor. Yeah.
Count it.
That's good.
All right. Well, with that, you've survived the lightning round. Dr. Singhal, thank you so, so much for generously giving so much of your time and talking to us and teaching us about HCC.
No, thank you. I'm Alice Adam. It was really a pleasure. A lot of fun.
We are now joined by Rob Wilchansky, a transplant hepatology fellow at MGH and the hepatology editorial fellow. Rob's going to be joining us to highlight high impact papers from the journal periodically throughout the year. So Rob, thank you for coming on.
Thank you both for the opportunity to be on this show. Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So what we envision this segment to be is through Rob's journey as the editorial fellow, just highlighting some high impact papers that we think will be of interest to the listenership. So we really, really appreciate it. Rob, why don't you give us the paper that you chose for this episode?
Sure. Yeah. So the paper that I wanted to highlight is a recent randomized controlled trial in NASH, or MASH, as we now call it, metabolic associated steatohepatitis.
If you insist.
Exactly. Of tropifexor plus cenicriviroc combination versus monotherapy, results from a phase 2B tandem study. A bit of background here. And you guys want me to just jump into it?
Sure.
And I think perhaps to make this listenable at all, you can use the shortened names for each of the meds moving forward. For those that want to read the actual paper, that'll be in the show notes.
Exactly. So, yeah, tropifexor will be TXR and cenicriviroc will be CVC. So a bit of background. So we don't really have approved therapies for steatohepatitis yet. There's been a lot of clinical trials ongoing in the past half decade. Obviously, we can't go through all of those here, but many of the agents up to this point have not had great efficacy or have not necessarily met histological endpoints like reduction of fibrosis. But with some of the more recent trials, though, we're getting closer to that and getting closer to having drugs that we can use in clinical practice. And so the drugs in this study are both oral drugs targeting mechanisms that promote MASH progression. And given that it's so complex, the idea is to target multiple mechanisms with the goal of an additive effect. And so both medications have had some success in phase two studies as monotherapy, but this study wanted to look at how they would do together. And so the mechanisms here, briefly, TXR is a farnesoid X receptor agonist, and that is known to regulate bile acid metabolism and regeneration during liver injury. And CVC is an inhibitor of CCR2 and CCR5, which are receptors on macrophages, generally reduce inflammation. That's the thought. The TANDEM trial, which is the study this was based in, is a 48-week phase 2B multi-center double-blind randomized controlled trial, 65 centers across 17 countries. They set it up with four treatment arms. The two arms were either CVC or TXR monotherapy, and the other two arms were combinations of a lower dose TXR plus CVC and a higher dose of TXR plus CVC. They included adults with histologic MASH and F2 or F3 fibrosis and excluded significant alcohol use and, you know, really advanced liver disease or other liver conditions.
So patients with at-risk NASH who didn't have cirrhosis, basically.
Exactly right. The main endpoint was to evaluate the safety and tolerability of the TXR and CBC combinations. There were two secondary endpoints as well, at least a 1-point improvement in fibrosis stage without worsening steatohepatitis or resolution of steatohepatitis without worsening fibrosis. They took paraliver biopsies, liver biochemistries, and a subset of patients got MRI with fat fraction. And so there are 158 patients who actually completed the study. And around, just a caveat here, about 80 to 90% of the study population was white, and about 80% of them reported having diabetes. So a pretty sick population, about 60% had F3 on histology. In terms of safety, generally speaking, very few serious adverse events at all. Only 21 actually withdrew from the study due to an adverse event, and that was due to usually pruritus, which TXR being a FXR agonist is pretty common, obeticholic acid being the other famous one in that group. That's actually something that is known for that class of medications. But other than that, generally, the combination of drugs was felt to be safe. For the secondary endpoints, the TXR and the combination groups.
Oh, you're teasing us, Rob.
I'm just teasing. Yeah, I was about to say, you're really lifting us up just to let us down.
Yeah.
But give it to us, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
So there were reductions in AST, ALT, and GGT from baseline in the TXR and the combination groups. And about half had MRI PDFF, and then all of the TXR groups showed reduction in hepatic fat fraction, or HFF, and the highest was shown in the combination groups. And on histology, about 30% in each group had at least a 1-point improvement in fibrosis, and that's actually pretty consistent with other trials, although there wasn't a placebo group here, so we can't necessarily compare to placebo. And then between 13 to 25% had resolution of steatohepatitis without worsening fibrosis. What's interesting is when they actually digitally quantified the liver fat and fibrosis on histology, they noticed that the combination groups had an additive effect in terms of fibrosis reduction, with the highest dose TXR and CVC showing the greatest effect. It's kind of interesting that this wasn't really the case on conventional microscopy. And so a few takeaways here from this study. Number one, you know, and these are probably the most important points that I took away from it. It's an example of safely combining agents that target fibrosis and steatohepatitis in MASH and MASH through different pathways. And this is useful for the future, especially when you look at positive trials of other meds, such as the FGF21 analog that was recently in a New England Journal of Medicine article. And we can be encouraged that other combination trials could also be safe, may lead to more benefit. And two, there was a substantial proportion of patients who had a reduction in fibrosis in all groups. Three, even though the combination didn't necessarily differ from monotherapy in terms of conventional histologic endpoints, there's some evidence on digital quantification that there was an additive effect on fibrosis reduction. And it raises some questions. And, you know, obviously the biggest buzzword, you know, in so many industries has been AI, right? And so how will we use that in the future, use digital methods to actually quantify what conventional histology can't? And that's something that's an open question, I think, in the NASH trials. But I'd love to hear what you both thought about this article and any other things you wanted to add.
I think it's an interesting proof of concept of combining two different mechanism of action drugs together. And I think the thing that it made me think about after reading it is how we're going to tailor these mechanisms to the individual patient, right? Are we heading towards a future where different mechanisms and different therapeutics targeting different targets are going to be tailored towards the individual patient? Now, like you said, we don't even have an approved drug yet, but I think eventually, you know, my mind, you know, want to, is that what the future is going to be with all these agents in development and the trials that we're expecting the results of?
Exactly. And this isn't even the first combination study in this realm. And I think we're going to see plenty more to come. It makes me think about, you know, how we mix and match drugs and diabetes, you know, currently, right? And is that the future of NASH or MASH, I should say? And how will that look in terms of our clinical practice going forward?
And then who's going to get it, right? So who are the patients with MASH? Whose insurance companies are going to pay for these medications at first? You know, is it going to be F3 to try to prevent them from progressing into cirrhosis and reduce their cancer risk? Or is it going to be F2? Those are questions for the future, but things that I think about when I start thinking about who's going to be getting these medications moving forward.
For sure. And we may end up seeing something not dissimilar from DAA rollouts for Hep C, where it starts with one population and then within X amount of time, it gets to more people. Obviously, there's the pharmacoequity side of this as well, in that every new medication, and it doesn't seem like these are going to be the ones necessarily, but it's always worth looking out for as things come down the pipe, that it does seem like the same groups of people do not have access to the new medications over and over and over again. So that's something to keep in mind. In terms of the study itself, interesting that there was no placebo, but I think they were more trying to answer a different question, which was sort of combo, and it's very nice of them. As we've talked about many times on this podcast, we appreciate names of trials, and tandem trial was right on the nose, as it were. I thought the pruritus rate was very high. I mean, I think we've all treated patients that either have pruritus from some form of liver disease or their medication is causing it, and I feel like it's the side effect that can really just destroy quality of life. And so 40% rates with the TXR is concerning in terms of being able to get people to actually stay on this med long term. It was a big trial in some ways. It was a very small trial in other ways. Each of the arms only had 50 people in it or thereabouts. And they raise it as well, questions surrounding power to sort of detect something. But we know that there was no serious adverse events or a worsening of the risk profile by combining them. But unfortunately, I don't think these are, at least in combo, going to be what we end up with.
Any final thoughts, Rob?
I'm encouraged by the fact that there were no real serious adverse events in combination. I was happy to see that, but I do agree that safety is one thing, tolerability is another. We're going to see going forward whether or not the farnesoid X agonists as a class are really going to be something that patients and providers reach for in the future. Time will tell.
Rob, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. If you're interested, go check out the article in Hepatology. We will link it in the show notes, and we will have Rob back on the next episode to highlight another article from his very, very prestigious job as the Hepatology Editorial Fellow. Rob, thank you so much.
Very, very prestigious. Thank you, guys.
It's a prestigious beat you're on.
Yes,
so
indeed.
So thank you for joining us.
Indeed. Thank you guys so much for having me. That was awesome.
Great episode, if we may say so ourselves.
Yeah, let's call it.
Thank you again to Dr. Singhal for a lot of words of wisdom regarding HCC, and Dr. Wilichansky for his great job talking through that paper. Hopefully people enjoy that segment, because we'd like to keep bringing it back. Well, hopefully Dr. Wilichansky enjoyed that segment as well and would like to bring it back as well. We think it went well. Any parting words of wisdom, Dr. Winters?
No, just good luck on your first day of faculty.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing all of your success as you transition into this very fun time in your life.
Thank you. This was much better than the intro words. So thank you.
Well, you know, I had a chance to think about it, you know.
Thank you to all our listeners, particularly Dr. Andy Coyle.
Yes, thanks, Andy.
And, of course, our fearless editor, Taylor Guterman. Bye, Adam.
Bye, Alex.